Well, when I was a little fella, for the first 6 years of my education, I attended a two-room schoolhouse. Now, you might think either I'm very old or I come from a very rural area. And the answer is yes. Those two rooms were on the first floor of a two-story building that was a Grange Hall. Anybody familiar with the Grange Hall? Okay, some people are. It's kind of like a co-op. The top floor was a meeting hall, had a large stage and open auditorium. Town meetings were there, and school functions were held there as well. The two rooms downstairs, one held first, second, and third grade, taught by Mrs. Gage, and the other fourth, fifth, and sixth, taught by Mrs. Jeannie P. Benjamin, one teacher in each classroom. When I was in the fourth or fifth grade, I don't remember exactly what it was. I do remember we were all gathered, all the students were gathered on the second floor of the building in the Grange Hall to prepare for some kind of school function. We were rehearsing something. And we were just milling around waiting for things to begin. And I was sitting there in the front next to a friend of mine. And I noticed a very peculiar odor. And I said, boy, something stinks in here. And my friend, I put friend in quotation marks, my friend said, must be Mrs. Gage. At that point, Mrs. Gage walked by. She caught her name. She said, what? And my friend turned to her and said, I said something stinks in here. And Cecil said, it must be Mrs. Gage. She did not even hesitate. She swung around and slapped me right up beside of the face. Now, I never in the years that I was in her three classes or in the years that I was next door in four, five, and six saw her discipline any student in a physical way. But she was just so shocked that she did that on his word. I was falsely accused. I wonder if any of you have ever been falsely accused. Time magazine published an article about Raymond Donovan in the 1980s. I don't know if you're familiar with that name. He was a secretary in the cabinet of Ronald Reagan. He has the distinction of being the first sitting cabinet minister ever to be indicted on criminal charges. Now, eventually, the charges were proven false, but long before that happened, he had to resign his position, and he had to hire attorneys to defend himself and so on. He was indicted on charges of larceny and fraud in conjunction with a construction project. In the grueling criminal investigation and subsequent trial, 2 years passed by. 2 years and $13 million in defense fees. That's what he had to pay out to defend himself. He was totally acquitted in the end, and the charges were so ridiculous that several members of the jury stood up and applauded when the not guilty verdict was announced. However, his reputation was in tatters. After his acquittal, he is remembered for famously asking, which office do I go to get my reputation back? You may have heard of a more current politician recently saying that about himself, but it originally came from Donovan back in the 1980s. I don't want you to think that my most serious case of misjudgment in my life was when I was in the fourth or fifth grade. There are other times. We won't go into those. But in reality, I think probably everyone in the room here, if you haven't had it yet, you will have, has been misjudged. And undoubtedly, your reputation has been dinged, it has been damaged, it has been stained a little bit. The question for you today, where do you go to regain your reputation after it has been damaged or stained a little bit? I can give you the answer. Donovan didn't find it, but I can give it to you. First, I want to look at an outstanding story in the Old Testament about a case of misjudging motives and actions. And we're going to learn a number of lessons from this. We're going to dive into the history of Israel right at the time after King David was made king over all of Israel. If you remember your biblical history, he was crowned king of Judah first. The rest of Israel did not accept him as the king for a number of years, 7 years actually. He was king only of Judah. When he was made king over the rest of the tribes, he tried to, or he took actions to stabilize the region. He worked on his international relations. Any newly appointed head of state does that to this day. One nation that he wanted to settle a good relationship with was the nation of Ammon. It was located north and east of Judah, north and east of Jerusalem, where he was reigning from. We pick up the story in 2 Samuel chapter 10. You won't know most of the names in here unless you're a truly biblical historian, true historian of the Bible, but you will recognize them as we go on. You have heard of the background here, whether you immediately recognize it or not. 2 Samuel chapter 10. It happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. And then David said, I'll show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent by hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father. Condolences sent. Again, nations do that still to this day. And David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David really honors your father because he sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out for the purpose of overthrowing it? Therefore, Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away. Not a very friendly thing to do, to say the least. When they told David, that is, the ambassadors, the representatives of David, sent word to him, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. They didn't come back to Jerusalem. The king said, you stay at Jericho till your beards grow back. And obviously, he put clothes on them. When the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, the people of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and from Ishtob, 12,000 men. So we had a considerable gathering, a huge army. A war is about to take place as a result of this particular incident that we read of here in Bible history. Now, these people that are mentioned, the Syrians of this place and the Syrians of that place, were to the north, due north of the area of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, they had encroached upon Israel. And we'll come to more of their story a little bit later. But their situation was a little different from Ammon. Ammon did not attack Israel, but the people of Syria had. Anyway, the Syrians joined in and joined the army to fight against David and the people of Israel. David heard about it. He sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men, and the fight was on. And then the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array at the entrance of the gate. The Syrians of Zobah, Beth Rehob, Ishtob, and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Give you a little more background on this, the New International Version Cultural Background Study Bible on 2 Samuel 10:4 about the envoys, the men that David sent. They write, in the ancient world, heads of state generally did not travel to other countries on diplomatic missions. Just this last week, our President Biden traveled to Israel and over to the Palestinian territory and then down into Saudi Arabia on a diplomatic mission. Well, until relatively in recent history, that was done by envoys or representatives of the head of state, not the head. Messengers were used who, like ambassadors, were understood as fully representing the person and authority of the king. So David sent counselors, envoys, ambassadors. It was just like David himself going. They spoke as the king, and they were to be treated as if they were the king. It's very important. That was how diplomacy was dealt with. Shaving off half the men's beard and cutting off their garments at the buttocks, there's nothing in history, biblical history or world history, that shows the particular symbolism of that, except that we know that wearing a beard at the time for a man was customary, and shaving it off would be a humiliation. You don't see this in many places. There's so many people who dress weirdly these days, you probably can find it somewhere, but usually if somebody has a beard, it's a full beard, or a goatee or something. It's not clean shaven on one side and then fully grown on the other side. And it goes without saying that cutting off your garments at the buttocks was just plain humiliating, just embarrassing. Hanun's treatment of the envoys clearly constituted a calculated, direct affront to David, says this Bible study Bible. Not surprisingly, it started a war between the two states. David's beard was, in effect, half shaved off. his garments, in effect, were cut off at the buttocks by the action of the king of Ammon. The king of Ammon terribly misjudged the situation. We don't know how many Ammonites were killed. They were the primary ones to start the war, but the Bible tells us here how many Syrians died as a result of Hanan's misjudgment. Let's go ahead a few verses in the chapter, down to verse 18. Then the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers. And if you check this record with the record of 1 Chronicles 19, that's the parallel record, you'll find there that it says 700 charioteers, or 7,000 charioteers, 700 here. The commentaries say that probably 7,000 is a more likely number, 7,000 drivers of the chariots, and 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians, and struck Shobak, the commander of their army, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants to Hadad-Dezer, who was one of the kings of the Syrians, saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians were afraid to help the people of Ammon anymore. World history was changed as a result of Hanan's misjudgment, and thousands of people died. Think of the number of widows. Think of the number of orphans as a result of about 50,000 people being put to death on the battlefield. Now, we have relatively modern death totals in battles in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and even though they number in the thousands over a period of 20 years, it doesn't begin to compare with the kind of battles that you can read of in the Bible history here. 40-some thousand, 47,000 approximately killed in one battle. There was a tremendous cost that people paid for this misjudgment. There were nations that could have been friendly with Israel and could have prospered with Israel after this who did not, and people whose lives were cut short. Obviously, the king of Ammon, Hanan, made a grave mistake and a high price was paid. Why did he do this? Why did he decide to act the way he did? Obviously, he lacked wisdom. He did not seek God's wisdom. I wondered as I was going through this and thinking about it if he was perhaps jealous of David. David was a highly successful king. He had been king for 7 years there in Judah and recently crowned a king over all of Israel. And as I say, that was the neighboring nation to Ammon. And maybe he was a little jealous. I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. Maybe Hanan was trying to prove himself. He personally just took over the throne from his father, who was deceased. Heads of state do that occasionally when they first are put into position. Maybe he had a little inferiority complex and he was trying to prove himself because he was a new king. We don't know. But we do know that he made a cascade of mistakes. Let's break this down and talk about the specific mistakes that he made. He doesn't seem to have ever calculated the possibility or considered the possibility that he could have been wrong. A touch of arrogance there. There's nothing that indicates a hesitation. He never questioned the ambassadors personally. At least the Bible doesn't indicate that he did. They came. I don't know if they made a court presentation or if they just talked to the advisors, but there's no indication that he ever communicated with them. He went instead with his opinion, with his gut reaction, if you will. That is human nature. That was a mistake. Hanan also chose to accept bad advice from the princes. The princes are not to be ignored. They were the chief advisors of the throne. They were the cabinet-level ministers or secretaries, if you will. Let's read again verse 3. The princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanan their lord, "Do you think that David really honors your father because he sent comforters to you?" And then they asserted that it was a spy mission, and David was going to do to Ammon what he had done to Syria. We'll get to that in a minute, but there was some reason that they could point to and say, look, you can't trust this David. You can't trust what he's doing. Hanan the king should have been able to trust these advisors. They're the top ones to go to. I would say it's the Google of the day, but it's better than Google. These are the wise men who are supposed to be able to guide the king and the country. They gave terrible advice. They made a bad judgment, and he chose to accept that. Perhaps because they would reinforce his gut reaction. That seems to be the indication that he was inclined this way. That would be human nature. to find an advisor who agrees, or advisors, plural, who agree with what you're inclined to think. Hanun also chose to let the past color his thinking. Now, this, you don't read it immediately in the context. You'd have to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 11 to get the story about his father. You do know this story, and as soon as I tell you about it, some of you anyway are going to go, yeah, I remember that. When Saul was first made king, not David, but when Saul was first made king, 50 years before, he was made king, and then he went back out into the field. He wasn't doing kingly things, sitting on the throne, ruling the country. He was out farming or ranching, whatever it was. And the city of Jabesh Gilead was surrounded by the Ammonites under King Nahash. King Nahash told the people of Jabesh Gilead at the time, you guys surrender, or I'm going to gouge all of your eyes out. You know, this is not a way to make a good treaty with your neighbors. It's a horrible, assertive, aggressive, mean-spirited thing that the king of Ammon did. Well, Saul rallied all of Israel. This is when he took an oxen, cut it in 12 pieces, sent the pieces around all the tribes of Israel, and says, this is what you'll like if you look like if you don't come to help. Well, all of Israel rallied. Jabesh Gilead was rescued. Ammon and Nahash were defeated, and Saul was established king. Important thing to note here is 50 years before what we're reading in 2 Samuel 10, 50 years before, Ammon was humiliated by Israel. And the advisors could well have remembered that. They could have used the past to justify their judgment in the present. That is also human nature. Oh, I remember, and because I remember this, then that is the conclusion. That's what I will do. Hanun allowed, or maybe even steered, public opinion to reinforce his judgment. Let's look again at verse 6. When the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, the people of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000, and from the king of etc., etc. Oh, no, come on. No, they didn't. The people of the United States wouldn't hire the people of England or UK to go with the Americans into Ukraine or wherever it is. The people of Ammon didn't get together and hire anybody, but public opinion was such that the king was able to make an alliance with the different kings of Syria. They didn't have Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and Twitter and tweets and all that kind of thing going out at the time. Who knew what the public opinion was of a nation? It was just word of mouth, but it was strong. And it got stronger to the point that the people actually hated, the people of Ammon actually hated the people of Israel. When they saw they made themselves repulsive to David, they said, let's make these alliances. They were in agreement with that. Hanun misapplied here the principle of Proverbs 24, verse 6. This is a Sabbath for looking at Proverbs, I guess. Proverbs 24, verse 6 is one you know, but I'd still like to read it. For by wise counsel you will wage your own war. This was a war, an extensive war. Tens of thousands of people died, and he did get counsel before he went to war. So why didn't things work out? And in a multitude of counselors, there is safety. I've heard this quoted by several in the church in decades past as there were problems within the church. Well, you know, I talked to a lot of people, and you know, this is what happened. Well, Hanun made the mistake of reading the principle as if it said, in a multitude of people who agree, there is safety. That's not what the proverb says. Get into more on that later on. Agreement in judgment does not automatically make it true or accurate. It's a common error in today's world, and it too is human nature. And reflecting on things going on and current events, I just shake my head when I read that public opinion in January of this year was against abortion after the 15th week. For abortion after the 15th week. And by March, it went the other way, and public opinion then was in agreement that there should not be abortions after the 15th week. And I thought, well, what changed? How could something be wrong in March that was right in January? Just because the public's opinion changed. Public opinion should be noted. We should address it. But you cannot go that way and say, well, this is what's right because this is what the public is in agreement with. Hanun went along with or initiated alliances with nearby kingdoms that were already prejudiced against King David. This is where the Syrians come in. I told you that they had encroached on Israel. Let's go back a couple of chapters, chapter 8, verse 3. David defeated this Hadadezer. You remember that name from a couple chapters later that we just read, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. So the Syrians had encroached on the territory of Israel, and when David was establishing himself as king of Israel, he got Israel's territory back. He took from this king 1,000 chariots, several hundred horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers. So these people had been defeated in war not too long before Ammon came and said, hey, I'm having a little trouble with David. What do you think? Surprise, surprise, the Syrians said, we're ready. We're on your side. That David is not to be trusted. The Israelites are bad people. We'll go against them in war along with you. This, too, is human nature, to seek out as many allies as you can who support your thinking. Didn't challenge his thinking. He knew they were going to support his thinking. Lastly, you may come up with other things that he did that he should not have. But lastly, the last point I have is that he chose a win-lose approach. I want to read again from a proverb, chapter 30, verse 33. Another one that you're familiar with, hopefully. Someone told me one time, I guess more than one time I've heard it, I wish ministers wouldn't say you all know this because I didn't know it, and even if I did know it, it's good to read it again. Proverbs 30, verse 33, for as the churning of milk produces butter, the wringing of the nose produces blood, so the forcing of wrath produces strife. Hanun's approach poked David in the nose. You know, much more assertively than that, or much grosser than that, he wrung David's nose. He wrung David's face in it. Hanun guaranteed that there would be war as a result, that blood would flow. Choosing to settle a problem with conflict is human nature. Okay, let's look now at the other side and ask and answer the question, what could Hanun have done differently so that he would have judged rightly? What would have saved the thousands of lives? What would have changed the course of history? Ammon would have allied with Israel. The Syrians would not have lost as many men. Perhaps they would have allied with Israel. Well, first, Hanun could have treated David's ambassadors with respect and courtesy, as well he should. They were ambassadors of a strong neighboring nation. It wouldn't have cost Hanun anything. It could have led to a word which is much bantied about these days, and I've come to despise it because I hear it so much in the press and government officials, the word conversation. Say, well, we need to have a conversation about, you plug in, fill in the line, they have a conversation about all these people assaulting justices and so on. Well, if a conversation led to resolution, it would be good. So conversations are good, and acting without conversation is bad. But Hanun did not go the way of a conversation. He could have treated these men with respect, had a conversation, asked them, you know, why are you fellows really here? Tell me what David is really like. I mean, he attacked the Syrians. What guarantee do I have that he's not going to attack us, the Ammonites? He could have, in a word, exercised some humility. Humility. Now, that does not come natural to human beings. That's not human nature. Hanun could have chosen not to accept the wrong opinions of others. He didn't have to take the advice just because other people gave it, even though those people were of position and notoriety. Now, that's tricky. If you have somebody who gives you advice who is in an established position, a position of authority maybe, a position of notoriety, a person who is a professional counselor, what have you, as these men were, he did not have to take their opinion. He could have resisted the wave of public opinion. As I noted earlier, just because the public is all this way or that way, this in January, that way in March, you don't have to take it. I've got to catch up with Mr. Richards here. He said, take a drink for every mistake he made, and I'm way behind. The key to the proverbial principle about safety in a multitude of counselors is in choosing genuine counselors. I think it's fair to say that all counselors have some prejudice. They all have an agenda of some sort. They all come from some kind of a background. And I'm talking about in the world, and you have to be wise in selecting those counselors, and frankly, you have to be willing and able to perceive when you're getting wise counsel and when you're not. How do you check that? Well, you know what you would do. You would check it according to God's word. But that is how that proverb works. In a multitude of counsel from genuine counselors, in a multitude of wise counsel, there is safety. Advice, you get it from people who have the wisdom, the experience, and the spiritual maturity to give genuine advice. That advice would be based upon fact, not upon prejudice. And this choice, finding those kind of counselors, is not typical of human nature. You can see where we're going. We're going with the typical human nature, with that which comes naturally, and checking it with that which does not come naturally. Hanan could have taken the advice of Proverbs 15, verse 1. This one I'm just going to quote from the King James and read it to you from another translation. A soft answer turns away wrath. You go, yeah, I've heard that one. The International Standard Version, the ISV, has a gentle response diverts anger, but a harsh statement incites fury. Had he chosen a soft answer, it wouldn't have cost him anything. Even if he found out the ambassadors were truly there to spy on him, he could still have allied with others and gone against Israel. He still could have rallied his troops. It wasn't too late. He didn't have to lose anything. But the way the approach that he took guaranteed problems. He wrung the nose. He could have chosen in that way a win-win situation. Divert the anger, divert the fury, and then see if he could resolve the situation. But the way of working towards peace, that way of working towards peace, again, does not come naturally. Lastly, he could have chosen to let go of the past. Boy, that's not an easy one. This is a pretty serious history that King Saul, when Israel was first established, just hammered Nahash, the father, and Ammon, and defeated Ammon soundly and established Israel as a major power. The first time they had a human king. Remember, they had a God as their sovereign before. So there was a history there that he looked at, and you could make a case that, well, you know, this happened. I can argue this, but there is a time to let go of the past. Proverbs 17, verse 9 speaks to this. He who covers a transgression seeks love. You say, well, wait a minute. You're not supposed to cover all transgressions, are you? Well, there is a time to. Calls for, again, wisdom. But he who repeats a matter separates friends. Think of the advisors of Hanan. They repeated this history from the father, I'm assuming, from 50 years before, and they did separate the friendship between David and the people of Ammon. You might have missed that when we were reading in 2 Samuel chapter 10. Let's go back there. Because the history was not just one of Israel against Ammon, Israel defeating Ammon. Let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 10. And again, where we began, verse 1, it happened after this, is after David established Israel's boundaries in the north, that the king of the people of Ammon died. This is Nahash. His son Hanan reigned in his place. And then David said, I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me. So what happened 50 years before was not the end of the story. There was more background. At some point during those 50 years, Nahash showed kindness to David and made some kind of a treaty. Now, one of the commentaries I read speculated that they made a parity treaty, which would be virtually a treaty between equals. So there's no record in history, secular history or biblical history, what treaty was made. But they did have some kind of a friendship relationship. Hanan did not choose the latter history of his father and David. He chose the early history. Nahash had let go of his animosity toward Israel, and Hanan chose to hang on to it. Well, Hanan is the one who lost his reputation in this story. He misjudged David, and he ascribed to him a terrible reputation. But instead of David coming out blackened by this, Hanan was. And we're reading about his misjudgment to this day. It's written here in the Bible so we can read about it, take it apart, parse it, think about it, and apply it to our own situation. That often happens. I'm going to make a misjudgment, or someone makes a misjudgment. It comes back on the person who has the wrong way of thinking. What should we take away from this? Take another drink of Richard's water here. One mistake. Two mistakes. Next thing you know, Mrs. Gage will be coming up here. I acknowledged that probably you've all been misjudged. I won't even go to the place to suggest that you all have probably misjudged somebody else. But I will confess that I have. Once. Okay, maybe more than once. I got to take another drink of water for that. It's life, isn't it? People misjudge each other. How do you know what's going on between the ears of someone? It's just so hard to know someone else's thoughts and beyond that, their motivations. I said that I would tell you where you can go to regain a lost reputation. Okay, let's talk about that now. Now, I'm referring to the most important reputation. We can't help Secretary Donovan, the fellow who lost $13 million in court, and we can't help Hanan except to talk about him in the past, but we can talk about the most important relationship reputation that we have, which is with God. If you have your relationship with God tainted, it will affect your relationship or your reputation with the people of God, the congregation in which you live, and the broader congregation of the Church of God. Here is the place where we can go to regain our reputation. Here in God's church. It has to be here. It can't be in a court. You go to a court, Donovan got acquitted, and what do you get? He got applause from the people in the jury and a bill from his attorney. I mean, he did not get his reputation back. And David got his reputation back, but thousands of people lost their lives as a result. I'm talking about a full restoration and a full repair of a reputation. Why do I say that the Church of God is the place where you regain your reputation? There are four reasons why this is true about the church. And I know that some of you are thinking, well, it's not true about me. I mean, I got hurt and hurt. Things were said, and I was hurt, and this and that happened. Stick with me. Number one, we take responsibility for our actions and our motivations. We don't need the neighboring king to come and say, you know what he was thinking? You know what she was thinking? We do that. We look at our own motivations and our own actions. There's a new blog on Life, Hope, and Truth website that was posted just yesterday about the fact that people need to take responsibility for their actions. The world in which we live, in large part, especially the Western world, pushes the philosophy of it's somebody else's fault. It's somebody else's responsibility. The Church of God, the people of God, do not think that way. Hanan clearly did not take responsibility for his actions and motivations. He put that on advisors, put that on the people. He did not do it himself. What have you been thinking about, though, as you heard his story? You've all been thinking about, well, I remember when this happened to me. Oh, I got some advice. Did I listen to that, or how did I apply it? And what did I judge about this situation? You have applied the life circumstance to your life. That is godly character. You don't need somebody else to do it. You don't need to be taken to court to make that happen. Now, we don't live our lives based upon the judgments or the opinions of others. The Apostle Paul addressed this in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And speaking about himself, he was heavily criticized at many times, on many occasions, at many points in his ministry. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3. But with me, it's a very small thing if I should be judged by you or by a human court. Even if he was sued in court, he would not be deeply moved by that. In fact, I do not even judge myself. Well, don't we judge ourselves? I just said that we do. He's talking about condemnation. He would not be moved if somebody outside condemned him. He would not be moved even if a court condemned him. He's not talking about if he broke the law and if he did a criminal act. He's talking about being condemned for the way of life as a Christian. And as far as judging himself, he didn't condemn himself. And we should not. Christ said that we should not condemn other people and we should not condemn ourselves. He concerned himself with God, though. I know of nothing against myself, yet I am not justified this, but he who judges me is the Lord. He was concerned about his reputation with God. And he wanted to make sure that he was aware of what God thought of his actions and his motivations. That is, if Paul's actions and Paul's motivations, and not what people were saying about him. In Galatians 6, there are several verses here that we want to look at. Just look at two for now. Galatians 6, verses 4 and 5. But let each one examine his own work. And that's what we're talking about. That's the way we think in the Church of God, isn't it? What am I doing? Why did I do it? What was I thinking? In the privacy of your prayers before God, you remember what you did during the day. In the privacy of your prayers before God, when you're fasting, you reflect back on how things have been going recently, and you judge yourself on the basis of what's gone on. You judge your motivations. Let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. Not based upon what public opinion is, what the group think is, what the group advisors are, but on his personal relationship with God. For each one shall bear his own load. When it comes right down to the end, the final judgment is not what people are saying about you. It's what God thinks about you and me, isn't it? And we're aware of that. We take responsibility for our actions and our motivations. Number two, we have only one set of weights. I'm not talking about weightlifting. I'm talking about the proverb, Proverbs 20, verse 10. Where it says that if somebody has two sets of weights, then God considers that an abomination. I read it to you from the Amplified Version, Proverbs 20, verse 10. Differing weights, one for buying and another for selling, and differing measures, both of them are detestable and offensive to the Lord. People would say, well, I wouldn't think of doing this in business. I buy gasoline by the gallon. The gallon is a certain size. That's what I buy by. But I sell it at a smaller size. Therefore, I get more money by selling it than I do. I get a better deal from selling than I do when I'm purchasing it. No, we don't want to do that. That's very dishonest in business. But everybody does it in human relationships. It's just human nature. When we have done something, and especially when it's exposed, people tend to say, oh, please don't think too harshly about me about that. They say, give me a break. What they mean is, use lighter weights when you're evaluating what I have done. But then when they turn to what other people do, oh, out come the heavyweights. Do you know what that person did? You know what I heard? And I heard it on, you fill in the blank, ABC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, FOX, MESS. I just threw that last one in to see if you're paying attention. It's all the same, isn't it? I heard it, therefore, well, not necessarily. We judge by our humans. People judge these different ways, but not so in the Church of God. We apply Matthew 7, verse 12. One set of weights. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, for this is the law and the prophets. This is what the Voice translation has for Matthew 7, verse 12. This is what our scriptures come to teach. In everything, in every circumstance, do to others as you would have them do to you. Use the same weights, whether you're buying or selling, whether you're selling your reputation or you're buying into someone else's reputation. In the Church of God, we use one set of weights. Number three, we doubt our own judgment. Well, aren't we supposed to have confidence? Yeah, you should be able to live with confidence. But here we get into what Hanan did not have, which is a dose of humility. In today's world, people are quick to accept their assumption, their gut reaction, just as Hanan did. They accept it as fact. And once they have an opinion, you know about it, because it's there, especially in social media. The opinions are out there, all kinds of opinions. Bang, things are being said before the facts are in. People are equally quick to voice those opinions. But as Christians, we are aware of the fact that we could be wrong. It'd be rare, wouldn't it? But we could be wrong. And we remind ourselves of that, and God's Spirit reminds us of that. We have a strong conviction. Maybe after the fact, after we've said something, we think, you know, maybe I shouldn't be so vociferous about that, as God's Spirit cautions us to think with humility. Self-awareness slows down any tendency to judge others, and Hanan lacked that. It can help us discover when our thinking is wrong, help us avoid making a mistake. Romans chapter 12, verse 3. Paul speaks to this. This I say through the grace given to me, that everyone who is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. It works the other way. We should not think less of ourselves than we ought to. You know, we shouldn't be falsely humble. We shouldn't walk around with our head down, looking at the ground all of the time, unless you have bad eyes like I do, and you have to do that. But you know what I mean. You shouldn't be downcast all the time. You should be able to be confident, but not so confident that you never question your own judgment. The Amplified Version here has, "For by the grace of God given to me, I say to every one of you not to think more highly of himself and of his importance and of his ability." Well, I know. Well, do I? Well, I heard from a good source. Was it? You know, we don't want to get over the top of our skis, as the expression goes, to go faster than our skis can handle, go faster than life justifies. Nobody should think more highly than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has apportioned to each a degree of faith and as a purpose designed for service. So there again is another way of saying that the judgment is slowed down a little bit. Being too quick often results in bad judgment. And then number four, we give others the benefit of the doubt. Number three was we doubt ourselves. And number four is we give others the benefit of the doubt. You're familiar with the term cancel culture today. It's gotten so common. It's just hard to keep up with who's canceled and why they're canceled. But people can lose their lifelong reputations, lifelong standing, as quickly as a cloud can come over the sun. Night, bright, sunny day, and then all of a sudden, why is it so dark? Well, a cloud came over the sun. People have lost their friendships. They have lost their jobs. They have lost relationships with coworkers. Some of them have lost family relationships just on a passing whim. There's no doubt given to people's opinion. They might be just out of sync with current public think. I have to be careful not to go there. There's so many things going on in the world that you could comment on about public think. I'm sure you could fill in the blank on all of these things. This entire phenomenon of cancel culture is based on a myth. It's based on the myth that the people who are canceling are above reproach. You know, what did Christ say? Who is without sin among you? Let him throw the first stone to stone a person who has sinned. And that we live with in the church. We abide by that. We do not rush into the judgment thinking that we personally are free of any difficulty. Therefore, we can point the finger. In God's church, we reject cancel culture. We realize that at any point in time, everybody in the church is A, building his reputation, B, maintaining his reputation, C, repairing his or her reputation. Because building our reputation, maintaining our reputation, repairing our reputation with God is Christianity. None of us is perfect. We are working toward perfection. So at any given point in time, you take, let's take Mr. Richards, for example, put him under a magnifying glass. Now I'm teasing him. Put anybody under a magnifying glass, his life, his judgments, his opinions. Will you find anything to question? With anybody you will, because that's humanity. None of us is there yet in terms of perfection. Because we recognize that we're all going through a process, then we are gracious with each other. There's a well-known series of messages in Revelation chapters 2 and 3 to the seven churches. I don't know that you've ever heard them applied this way, but you be the judge. I think it is an accurate way to apply it. Look at Revelation chapter 2 and begin in verse 7. This is the common message to the churches. And Christ said to each of them to hear what the Spirit says to the churches, plural. Quite commonly, we look at a message to one church and apply it. Chapter 2, verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Now, this is the church of Ephesus. And they were supposed to be overcomers. These promises are not written to him who never did or said anything wrong, who's always motivated with the purest of motivations. They are made to those who have thought wrong, spoken wrong, done wrong. Human beings, people in need of overcoming. At least that was true of the church at Ephesus. Chapter 3 and verse 5, this is to the dead church, the church of Sardis. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. It is possible for people in the dead church to overcome. They should never think of themselves, oh, there's no hope for me. Boy, I've just drifted so far that I'm dull and I'm out of it and I'm not practicing the faith of the way I should. Nor should anyone looking at them judge them and say there's no hope for them because they obviously are spiritually dead. Even the spiritually dead who are called to God and responded to God at one point, but who have gone to sleep and gone dull, can overcome. That's part of the message to the churches. Revelation chapter 3, verse 2. Not 2, verse... The Laodicean church is what I want here. Verse 21. Yeah. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. So even those people who are lukewarm, who are caught up in too much interest in the world, too much emphasis on personal possessions, too little emphasis on spiritual values. Maybe some people that you have known, maybe you are in that category, because as I say, there's a mix of categories. It's easy to look at these messages of the churches and say, here's the beginning of the church, there's the end of the church, as if you could dice them all, they're all separated with dividers. But Christ said, everybody and all the churches should pay attention to the messages to all the churches. And the message includes whatever extreme you're on spiritually. And if you're dead, that's a pretty severe extreme. Or if you're so caught up in material things that you're not on track spiritually, that's a great extreme. But either way, you can still overcome. But that's not the end of the message. In chapter 3, in verse 12. This is the faithful church. You know, I've studied church history, as many of you have, and I found a record for some Church of God records from the Middle Ages. And guess what church they identified with from the Middle Ages? With Philadelphia. say, well, we're the Philadelphians, we're the faithful church. And hopefully, at any point in time, there would be somebody, and I believe that's true, there would be some people in the church who would say, we are faithful, we are living by what it says here. It's important that we look at it that way, but look at this and consider this. Verse 12, he who overcomes. Well, wait a minute. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia, and it says all these nice things, I see you're faithful, but then it says to him who overcomes. Even the people who are Philadelphian, even the people who are faithful, have to overcome. Everybody is in the process of perfection. Nobody can say, oh, I'm the judge. I will decide if everybody else is doing what he should. We all are overcomers. We should be champions of overcomers. We should be believers in the possibility of overcoming. Never pigeonholing someone in our mind saying, no, this person is, fill in the blank, done, dead, or materialistic. We should be enablers of overcomers. Enablers of overcomers. With that in mind, turn to Galatians chapter 6. Again, I said we'd look at a little more on this. In this chapter, Galatians chapter 6. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, and I understand that word means to slip. If anyone slips, this is in the church. You could go back to Hanan's situation and say, David could have made a mistake and he could have been spying. I mean, Hanan could have been right. How would he have handled it if David had been wrong in that situation? Or in the church, you know somebody in the church family who has slipped. There's no question about it. And it's easy to say, well, you know, I don't judge. Yes, you do. We judge. You just do. God made your mind to make judgments. Now, human nature condemns. It goes beyond just making a judgment. But you can judge. You can judge whether it's warm, whether it's hot. You can judge whether somebody is speeding. You can judge whether somebody has good taste in matching colors. Don't look at my tie. We judge all the time. We make judgments. And we're supposed to. More on that in just a minute. Say you notice somebody is overtaken in a trespass. You who are spiritual, who at that moment are not overtaken, not having slipped with a trespass or a problem, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Considering yourself with humility and realizing that there are times when you are on the downside and your mission is not to tell everybody about this other person who's on the downside, not to get on the telephone, not to get on Instagram, not to get out the text, not to get out Snapchat, etc., and communicate all this opinion that you have. We don't do that. Do we? We don't do that. We are oriented to help people regain, repair, build, maintain their reputation before God. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. That's the way we think in the church. All of this, the story of Hanan, all the things that we've considered, all that we've gone to, really amplify one scripture. It comes from Christ's instruction to us in John chapter 7. Verse 24. This is the takeaway. This is the lesson. If you want to summarize it all, and then you can break it down into the individual points. But John 7, 24, Jesus said, do not judge according to appearance. That's what Hanan did. But judge, he didn't say avoid all judging, but judge with righteous judgment. Christ wants us to learn to do it righteously. Hanan did not. There's a new amplified version and there's an older one, classic version. This is from the classic. Translates the verse this way. Be honest in your judgment. Don't be dishonest. It's not what Christ is advocating. Do not decide at a glance, that is superficially or by appearance. Or we might add by what you hear. But judge fairly and righteously. Judging righteous judgment is a great responsibility. We've seen by the lesson from Hanan and David that it's not easy. We've seen from the application scriptures that it is a challenge. Hanan failed to do that. He failed to meet that responsibility, and we're still reading about his consequences. Now, our misjudgments are not going to lead to a war, but they can hurt feelings, and they can cause division, and they can separate friends, and they can tarnish reputations. But in God's church, we're helping each other build and maintain those reputations.